Welcome once again to the Mike Wilson Show on WWGH. I am waiting for a call from Fred Malone, who's going to discuss the Harding Memorial with us today. So, Fred, if you're out there, please go ahead and call in. There he is. Let's hold on here a second, folks. Hello, Fred? Yes, give me a second here and you'll be on the air. Fred Malone.
That's so that I hit at the end of your song.
There you are.
How are you?
Oh, I'm doing good. How are you doing?
Well, I can't complain. A little bit better today weather-wise, a little cooler than it was the last couple of days, which is a good thing.
Yeah, it feels so good, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's not bad. I think it topped out maybe in the low 80s, which is a good thing. We'll take it, a little bit less humidity maybe, and sounds good for the next few days, according to your weather report that I just heard a couple of minutes ago. So
yeah.
Sounds good.
Sounds super. Not been a bad summer so far. Of course, this is the second day of summer, I believe.
You're right. Absolutely. So, yeah, we're just getting a good start.
So yes, let's see what happens. And I think you're here today to talk about the Harding Memorial.
I'm going to talk a little bit about the life of our former President Harding, who of course was a Marion person, and then we're going to talk a little bit about the memorial. And if we have enough time, I wanted to talk a little bit about the contents in the cornerstone. I don't know whether too many people know that there was a cornerstone laid in the memorial, and there is a list of the contents, and I'm privy to a list, and so we'll talk a little bit about that.
That could be interesting.
If we have time, we'll try to keep time for that, because I think that will be very interesting.
Sure will.
But just starting off a little bit with a little information about Harding, and by the way, I'm not by any means an expert on Warren Harding. I'll have to leave that to Sherry Hall and the folks down at the Harding home and the new Presidential Center. They know considerably more than what I do on the subject of Warren Harding, but I have put together a little bit of information that I've been able to gather from several different readings that I've done over the years, and just want to kind of give an overview of Warren Harding since we are approaching the 100th anniversary of his election to the president, which of course occurred in November of 1920. And boy, you know, it isn't too long before it'll be November of 2020, Mike.
That's true. And you know, with Harding, there were a lot of firsts with his presidency.
There were, absolutely. You're
absolutely
right.
I'm sure you'll be mentioning at least some of those.
Yep, we will touch on some of those things. Well, anyway, to kind of start off, Harding, Warren Gamaliel Harding, was born November 2nd, 1865, out in Blooming Grove, which actually was not in Harding County, of course, and you should know well what county
that
was in.
That's in Morrow County.
to Dr. George T. and Phoebe Dickerson Harding, both of them, of course, descendants of pioneer families here in Ohio. He was the firstborn of a family of eight. In 1870, Dr. Harding, his father, removed the family to the village of Caledonia in Marion County. Now, here, Mrs. Harding, who was a very highly intellectual woman, deeply religious in nature, found time to raise her family and take an active part in the social and religious life of the community. Such was the background of Harding's boyhood. So it kind of laid out some of the things that he would presented his life as it went on.
Now, about his mother.
Yes.
I thought that I had read or heard at some point that she was also a doctor.
She was. She took her training at the same osteopathic school up in Cleveland, Ohio, that Dr. Sawyer got his degree from. Yeah, very interesting. You're absolutely right. Harding, his boyhood, of course, was in the Caledonia area. Dr. Harding had become part owner of the newspaper there in Caledonia called the Caledonia Argus. And so then young Harding got kind of interested in printing by way of that and did serve an apprenticeship in the press there. The one distinction of Harding's school days was being the editor of the college paper. He went to the Central College of Ohio there at Iberia, and showed rich promise as a public speaker. In 1882, he received his degree, a Bachelor of Science there from the college in Iberia. And, of course, you know, as we all know, that institution is now distinct. And I for a long time I thought maybe there was a building left out there, but I really think everything is gone now, if I'm not mistaken.
Now, I had heard that the one church sitting there was the chapel.
Yes, I've heard that. Right?
I'm not sure. I can't confirm that, but I've heard that.
I have heard that myself. By this time, the Hardings were living in Marion, and it was to Marion that Harding went after his graduation, armed, of course, with that degree. A printer's rule, and a fervent determination to make his own living. Before he became an editor, he had tried successively to teach school. He did study some law, and he sold insurance, all, you know, with his mind in different varying degrees of success. But in 1884, at the age of 19, Harding induced his father to purchase half interest in the Marion Star, which he published successfully until he sold it to the Brush Moore Syndicate in 1923, and we'll talk more about that as we progress in his career. It was during the presidential campaign of 1884 that this future president became very interested in politics, and despite the crushing Republican defeat of that year, he courageously declared the editorial policy of the Star as Republican to the backbone, and that's a quote from him, Republican to the backbone. In 1886, Harding became the sole owner of the Star. Now, in those days, of course, you know, he was faced with a very difficult task of building up circulation for a Republican newspaper and then a predominantly Democratic community. And, of course, that has changed somewhat. I think now the county of Marion is more like 2-to-1 Republican, so had a little bit of a switch there.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, he had several financial difficulties. A pitiful inadequacy of equipment, which, you know, proved himself equal to that occasion. Slowly but surely, he was putting the Star on a sound financial basis. Now, the fearless yet judicial essence of his editorials was very quickly becoming recognized throughout the state of Ohio, and he was also achieving a reputation as a political speaker. Remember, he had developed speaking habits while he was in college out of Liberia. And as time went on, as he became more and more interested in politics, his reputation grew as a speaker. Now, during this period of his life, the editor formed a habit for which he was never to discard, and that was in keeping close in touch with individuals of the public who he served. Now, in 1891, July actually, Warren Harding was married to Florence Kling DeWolf. Now, of course, she was the daughter of one of Marion's foremost citizens. And in the year before their marriage, they planned and built the house, which is now known as the Harding Home and Museum, located at on Mount Vernon Avenue, which, by the way, someone told me today that that last storm that we had that produced those pretty strong winds took down some limbs and narrowly missed that porch that they just spent about the last year.
Yes, I drove by there that night. I saw that. I was afraid that it hit the porch.
Yeah, I guess just a few of the smaller limb debris and some of the leaves fell on that upper tier that was like a balcony, you know, mm-hmm. above the rounded porch. But they kind of dodged a bullet from not having any more extreme damage from the limbs that came down. And I think we had like 60, 70 mile an hour winds during that storm. So I kind of got off the spot there a little bit. I thought that was kind of interesting to throw in. Mrs. Harding was a source of both inspiration and very helpful criticism to her husband during the years that followed. Hers was the chief force that built up the circulation department of the Star, of which she was in charge. And, of course, she's known for having developed the newsboys that would deliver the newspaper around town and on the street corners, too. And the Daily Issue, at that time, then surpassed any other newspaper in a town of equal size in the entire country, not just the state of Ohio, but in the entire country. So you have to give her considerable credit for having helped him develop that business. And, of course, her father, Amos Kling, being the shrewd businessman that he was, involved in not only mercantile but banking and several other business opportunities in the city of Marion, was very shrewd when it came to money. And she was an only child, so I think he had, from what we understand from people that I've talked to in the past that knew a little bit more about this, said that he had always wanted a boy. So she was kind of raised like a tomboy. Uh-huh. And had that astute ability that she inherited from her father of being a very shrewd businesswoman along the same line. So we really have to give her a lot of the credit for making the Star successful. Obviously, Mr. Harding was the one that had the great political editorials and the great editorials of the time, but business-wise, I think it was her that kind of kept the whole thing going,
sure.
You know. In 1900, Harding embarked upon a long and really brilliant political career with his election to the Ohio Senate. Now, he served two terms there from 1900 to 1904, and then in 1904, he was elected to the office of lieutenant governor. And that is when his political prowess really started to become nationally recognized. His campaign for the governorship of Ohio in 1910, however, did meet with defeat. Unfortunately, because of the split in the Republican Party, that created some of that problem. But in spite of this fact, he did defeat Senator Foraker in 1914 in the Republican primaries as a candidate for the United States Senate and was elected by a majority of 100,000 votes for the term that ran from 1915 to 1921. Now, obviously, he didn't complete that term because, as we're going to talk about here shortly, the election of 1920 came along and he was successful there. But he did make an honorable and a brilliant record while he was in the Senate. And in 1916, he actually presided as chairman of the Republican National Convention that was held in Chicago that year. And it's always been said that he really enjoyed his time in the Senate, and he enjoyed being a United States Senator. And I've heard several people that are real Harding historians saying that he really didn't care about the nomination for president, that was more of a Mrs. Harding thing than it was for him. I think he would have been happy, from what I've been able to find out, to have just served his time in the Senate, been elected for a couple of more terms, and retired from that august body. So, again, things don't always happen as we as individuals plan, and destiny sometimes called, and I think that's probably what happened with him in 1920. The 1920 primaries, well, not primaries, but the 1920 conventions, both in the Republican and the Democratic tickets, were very unusual. It took several ballots for each one of them to shake out a candidate. And I always like to point out to people when they're coming through the museum that in 1920 we had something extremely unusual happen. Both of the candidates for the 1920 presidential election were from Ohio, and both were editors of newspapers. Of course, Charles Cox being from Dayton, editor of the Dayton Daily News, and of course Harding, you know, being from the Marion Star. So that was something that had never happened before, and of course it hasn't happened since and probably will never happen, you know, the way things are today. But in 1920, backed by a loyal group of Marion friends and other supporters from the state, he did become a candidate for the Republican nomination for the presidency. As I said, the convention of 1920 in Chicago was one of the most stirring ever held in the history of the Republican Party. Because of the uncertainty of its outcome, on the first ballot, Harding received 65.5 votes, 39 of which were from his own state. On the 10th ballot, it took 10 ballots before he finally secured the nomination with a vote of 692.5, only 400 of which were necessary to be nominated, so he was well in excess of what he needed. The slogan for his campaign was a return to normalcy. Of course, we've all heard that said many times, because we were just coming off of the end of World War One, and that was a time of a lot of tumultuous activity going on abroad and in this country as well. He didn't stump the country, but of course, as we all know, conducted his campaign from the front porch of his own home, where scores of people and delegations, thousands of individuals came in by train daily into our local train station and proceeded down Center Street and around the corner to his house to listen to him speak from the front porch. Mm-hmm. Again, Mrs. Harding played an important part in this, as in every activity in which her husband was interested. In the November election, he won an overwhelming victory. Now, of course, he was a sitting senator, so he did have to resign from the United States Senate in December of 1920, and then his inauguration took place on March 4th of 1921. The earlier presidents, as you will recall, did all get get their inauguration in March, and I forget who they started with in January, but of course now our presidents are inaugurated in January.
Right. January 16th.
He was the sixth president that was elected from Ohio, and his inaugural address and his first message to Congress was delivered on April the 2nd of 1921, voicing his hope for the country's return to that normalcy. In the same message, he had advocated the adoption of a budget system, a complete revision of taxation, and a flexible tariff regulation. He brought about the Washington Conference of Arms Limitation. Both the conference and the introduction of the budget system were outstanding accomplishments of his administration. And under his administration, the vice president, for the first time, became an important factor in the governmental regime. And to Mr. Coolidge, his vice president, and who eventually became his successor, he left a very well-planned program of action. Now, the Harding administration may well be characterized as one that was wholly constructive, and he was perhaps the only man of his time who possessed the qualifications that were able to guide the United States through that dangerous period of Reconstruction that followed World War One. And remember, Wilson had a stroke during his second term, and he had some great difficulties with that second term. And it's often been said that his wife was actually Madam President during that time. So when he left the White House, there were a lot of uncertain things happening in the country. He called to his assistance a group of very able and distinguished citizens, a lot of them from Ohio, and his cabinet was one that will go down in history as notable for its statesmanship and its abilities. Now, of course, later on there were some issues that developed with the cabinet, some members of the cabinet. Of course, we all remember Teapot Dome. But really, truthfully, in all honesty, none of that was Harding's fault. He really had no idea what was going on. Sometimes the people you pick don't actually do what you want them to do or do things that you don't know about what's going on. I think that may happen even today.
It just might.
Throughout his career, though, he preserved that wholehearted generosity of his youth and an element in his character, which made him a very beloved figure at home as well as abroad. He was very kindly, a magnanimous disposition. He always gave credit wherever and whenever and wherever it was due. And, of course, in June of 1923, President and Mrs. Harding embarked on that famous trip across the continent to Alaska, the first president ever to make a trip to Alaska, and it was not a state yet, it was still a territory, which of course ended in his tragic death on August the 2nd of 1923 at the Palace Hotel in San Francisco. Now, he was ill really before they ever left Washington, D.C. He had been having some issues with his heart. At that time, I don't think they were particularly diagnosed as being that type of thing, but he had a barrel chest. If you've ever seen pictures of President Harding, he had what they referred to as a barrel chest and a high chest. And we do feel that now, based on what we know today from records that were kept then, that he had probably was suffering some congestive heart failure at the time he was still in the White House before they made this trip. In fact, he had gained quite a bit of weight from the time he was elected president and took office, or I should say the time that he took office and was in the White House. He was a great golfer. He played a lot of golf, belonged to Marion Country Club, of course, and played at the Congressional Country Club in Washington. And unfortunately, the rigors of being president did not allow the time that he had when he was a U.S. senator to get out and do those things, so his exercise level was decreased by quite a bit. So the problem with gaining weight. He of course, over-imbibed, as a lot of people did when they were sedentary, and that probably helped to, you know, kind of further this problem along. When he got into Alaska, I think there's so many rumors that swirl around about what actually happened, and contrary to popular belief, he wasn't poisoned or anything like that. But I think the stress of the trip, the rigorous schedule that he was trying to keep, the number of speeches that he was making on a daily basis, it just wore him down and took a toll on his body as well as his heart condition. By the time the train pulled into San Francisco and loaded him in a car to take him to the Palace Hotel there in San Francisco, he was suffering greatly. They wanted to take him directly to the hospital, but he insisted no, he didn't want people to see him in an ambulance and going to a hospital. So they took him by car to the hotel, and on his in his own power, he was able to exit the car and walk into the hotel and get to his room, upon which, you know, he collapsed. It was a grief-stricken nation that marked on the progress of the funeral train that ran from California to Washington. After an appropriate service at the Capitol, the cortege then proceeded back to Marion, where the body of the president was placed in a temporary tomb located in the Marion Cemetery, which the Marion County Historical Society had opened a number of years ago. I think you were doing you were doing behind closed doors then, weren't you, Mike?
Yes.
And we had that tomb open so people could actually see that. That was constructed to keep the bodies in until an appropriate memorial facility could be built. And then on December the 21st of 1927, after the completion of that memorial, which is what we see today and where they are now, the bodies were then moved over to the memorial. Mrs. Harding died roughly a year or so after the president passed away. She remained in Washington a short time and then came back to Marion. They had actually rented their home there that is now the museum. They had rented their home when they were sent to Washington, and when she decided to come back to Marion, she didn't want to displace the folks that were renting the house at the time, so she did move in temporarily with Dr. Sawyer and did reside for a time out at the sanatorium at Sawyer Ludwig Park now. But eventually, when she, after she passed away, then her body was put in the holding vault, so to speak, until the memorial was completed, and then they, of course, both moved over there to their final resting place. A couple of things I wanted to mention about Harding. That's just kind of some biographical background. Yeah, he was a very successful small-town businessman. I mean, he was very genial, very easygoing. He really wanted to, more than anything, be liked by the people in Marion and you know, the people in general. He was what you would call a Main Streeter. Have you ever heard that term?
Yeah, I believe I have.
He was a Main Streeter in the 20s. People, if you were a Main Streeter, you could walk down Main Street in your small town, your community, and everybody knew you.
Right.
They would speak to you or wave at you or whatever. Of course, again, he owned the newspaper. He was a director of a bank. He was a director of a lumber company here in town and a director of the local telephone exchange. He did play cornet in the Marion band, the local band. He loved to, of course, chew tobacco and smoke cigarettes and cigars. In fact, we've got the desk that he used when he was the editor of the Marion Star down at our museum here in Marion with the Historical Society.
Heritage Hall.
And there are several burn holes
in
the desk that you can see. He was a joiner. He liked to belong to a lot of clubs. As I mentioned earlier, he did belong to the Marion Country Club. 36 years, he was the publisher of the Marion Star. He never did dismiss an employee in 36 years. Isn't that amazing?
Yes.
And a lot of the people that worked for him, you know, for that length of time. He was definitely soft-hearted to a fault. He really could not believe that there was evil in any man. He thought there was good in everybody. And he never learned to say no. In fact, and this is a quote from him, he once said, "It's a good thing I'm not a woman. I would always be pregnant. I cannot say no." And that was told to some press club friends when they were here during the campaign in 1920. He just was a very sharp individual. He was really presidential looking. Of all the presidents we've had, I really think if you take a look at all their pictures, with the exception of maybe John Kennedy, he was probably the most of them that looked like a president.
Mm-hmm.
He was very handsome. He was big framed. He had large, wide-set eyes and a very pleasant, resonant voice. And I have heard his voice. They do have some recordings that you can actually go online and listen to of some of the speeches that he gave. One of the people that he did pick to become one of his cabinet members was Harry Doherty, who was also an Ohio man. He was from down in, if I believe it was either Circleville or Washington Courthouse. And he, of course, he was a very sharp-eyed politician. I think he was one of the ones that really became Harding's mentor and more or less mastermind his political career, and kind of took him, you know, under his wing, and kind of served as a protege, you know, so forth. But anyway, he was a very unique individual. I think there probably won't be another one quite like him in the years to come. And we in Ohio, and especially here in Marion, are, you know, proud enough to say that we live in Marion, and we do know some history about President Harding. Any questions there that I can?
Well, I'd like to add something.
Certainly.
You had said something about him being a joiner and being a part of a lot of organizations.
Yep.
Of course, you know I'm from Morrow County.
Yes.
We had what was called the Tokay Club.
You're going to have to explain that.
Well, it was a gentleman's club. I mean that in the sense of just men coming together to smoke and
uh-huh.
sing songs and so on.
Uh-huh.
That was on the third floor of a business downtown in Mount Gilead. And it was T-O-Q-U-E-T, I believe is how it's spelled. But the Morrow County Historical Society actually has the sign-in book from there.
Oh, really?
And we have his signature where he had signed into the Tokay Club.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I can't remember what year that was.
That's almost like croquet with just a couple of letters.
Yeah, that's true, yes.
Yeah.
Maybe they played croquet at the Tokay. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, he did belong to the Elks here locally. He was also a Mason. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, he might have belonged to the Eagles as well. But he, as I said, he was really a joiner. He belonged to a lot of different organizations.
Well, it's interesting you said he was a Mason. My great-grandpa Wilson was a Mason in Marion, and he died in the early 20s. So I bet...
Oh, I'm sure they had associations.
I bet he knew President Harding.
Yeah.
And my great-grandpa also publicly played the violin, which I have. So I'm just wondering if at some point they played together.
I wouldn't be a bit surprised.
Orchestra or something.
Since he was a cornet player in the local band, it's a very good possibility. Well, you know, Trella Romine always told the story that she got to shake his hand when he was campaigning on the porch when she was just a little girl. I think she was like 3 or 4 years old.
Oh, really?
And, yeah, she always said, "You want to shake the hand that shook the hand?" You know, and it was it was kind of one of her great stories that she liked to share with everybody. So. But a very interesting individual, and, you know, really been kind of discredited over the years as one of the worst presidents, you know. But I think he's really come into his own in the last 30 or 40 years. People realize, scholars, historians now realize that he did much more good than evil. He did, of course, like to smoke and like to drink, like we said before.
But that was common at that time also.
Almost every night.
Right. Those were common things at that time.
It was. It really was. So, I mean, it's nothing out of the ordinary.
Right.
So. But anyway, a little bit about the memorial. Of course, plans for raising the memorial were started, you know, very shortly after his death with the organization of the Harding Memorial Association, and that took place on October the 11th of 1923. So that was just, you know, a few months after his death. The purpose of the association, of course, was to erect and endow a fitting memorial to the memory of Harding, and, of course, to plan for the maintenance in perpetuity of the Harding home, too, as well. They did raise a sum of $977,800 in change for the purpose of erecting this monument. And it was done by popular subscription. There was no federal or state or governmental money at all involved in this. There were over 1 million contributors from all parts of the United States, Alaska, and the Philippines, as well as from several European countries. Included in that list of contributors were approximately 200,000 school children who contributed pennies to the fund.
Mm-hmm.
And a little side story on that, with the pennies that were left over from the school children's donation, they made 100 copper statuettes of Laddie Boy, and that was, of course, the president's dog, favorite dog.
Mm-hmm.
And those 100 statuettes were given to the dignitaries, both from the Memorial Association and the visiting dignitaries that came here to dedicate the memorial. Of course, both Coolidge and Hoover were here for that ceremony, as well as a lot of other dignitaries at the time, people at Ernie's Cabot and so forth. And the Marion County Historical Society was gifted one of those 100 dogs a number of years ago by one of our benefactors. So we have one of those dogs in our collection, and it can be seen in the Harding Rooms downstairs at the Marion County Historical Society. So that's kind of an interesting side note on those copper pennies that were donated by the school kids. Early in the year of 1925, a number of America's leading architects entered the competition to design this memorial. The commission ended up being awarded to a gentleman by the name of Henry F. Hornbostel and Eric Fisherwood of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, because of the unusual beauty and simplicity of their design, which was submitted. And because this plan in every respect deferred to the wishes of the president for a simple, under-the-sky burial. And, of course, as we all know, it's open on the inside. It's just like a giant ring. So that gave him that look that he was looking for. The first ground was broken for the construction of the memorial on April the 26th of 1926. And the ceremony of the cornerstone laying took place on May 30th of 1926. The stone, in which a collection of records and souvenirs were placed, and we'll talk about that here in a little bit, was laid by then Vice President Dawes. So that was a little bit interesting as well. On November the 21st of 1927, at a private service, the bodies of the President and Mrs. Harding were removed from the temporary tomb that was in the Marion Cemetery over to the completed monument. President Harding occupies the tomb to the left as one enters the memorial, which is marked by a bronze palm wreath.
Mm-hmm.
And Mrs. Harding is in the one to the right, at the foot of which is placed a bronze wreath of roses. The graves were approximately 15 feet in depth and are covered by two slabs of emerald pearl Labrador granite. Two of the most unusual and beautiful aspects of the tomb are the drooping willow tree at the head of Mrs. Harding's grave and the hanging garden in which California privet Japanese yew and English ivy had been planted. And, of course, the inside garden surrounding the graves is carpeted with a bed of myrtle. The monument is totally constructed of white Georgia marble. The diameter at the base of the monument is 103 feet, and its height is 52 feet. The exterior columns are 5 feet in diameter at the base, tapering slightly toward the top, and are 28 feet in height. And the interior columns are 2 feet in diameter and 16 feet high.
Mm-hmm.
The memorial is situated in the midst of 10 acres of beautifully landscaped grounds, 17 acres directly across the highway, also part of the memorial grounds, which is what we know now as the
Veterans?
Oh, sorry, Soldiers Memorial Area.
Okay.
And this landscaping was not yet completed, obviously, when the memorial was. Total cost of the monument, landscaping, and grounds was a little under $800,000. So there was money left over, and that's what went into the perpetuation fund. A couple more things I want to mention about the about the memorial. The cloister is actually formed by a Greek Ionic colonnade applied to the inner side of the circular wall. The columns of this cloister support a terrace which carries sufficient earth for permanent planting and surrounds a green swath of myrtle that we talked about earlier. Now, in the center of the myrtle bed, under the shed of this willow tree, are the two tombstones and the wreath that follow those up. It is totally of a Greek architecture and modified by some Roman effects. It's exemplified kind of like the Lincoln Memorial at Washington. If you really take a look at it, it kind of reminds you of something like that. The setting of the monument, of course, is kind of a happy setting, which you don't always say in cemeteries, but this kind of is. And there's sufficient grounds that were allowed then, of course, for fitting landscape composition. In general, rows of elms form the shape of a Latin cross, the tomb being placed at the intersection of the arms of the cross, while the main approach follows the trees of the cross. And behind the elms are clusters of trees and shrubbery. That's pretty much all I have on the memorial and the monument. Shall we talk about the contents of the cornerstone?
I think that'd be very interesting. I don't think I've ever heard this list.
There are 35 objects in the cornerstone. And the cornerstone, I don't know if I mentioned the date or not, but it was actually, the souvenirs were placed in the cornerstone, and it was sealed on Sunday, May the 30th of 1926. So I don't know whether there's any plans for doing anything with that cornerstone in 2026 or not. That would be up to the powers that be. And to my knowledge, the memorial is actually owned by the Ohio Historical Connection, I believe. They are the rightful owners of it. So I don't know whether there's any memorial association that's still in existence or not. Don't know. But it would be interesting if they had access to that to actually open that on the 100th anniversary of it. But, you know, some of those cornerstones aren't accessible only from the top. Mm-hmm. So once the monument is finished, can't get into them.
Okay.
Yeah. And I don't know about that one. I've never really looked at it that close. But, all right, starting off, we have a copy of the Saturday Evening Post. This is very interesting, which was being read to President Harding at the time of his death.
Oh.
And, of course, Mrs. Harding was reading to him at the time he died. He was sitting in his bed in the Palace Hotel in San Francisco, had actually taken some nourishment earlier in the day, had been talking both of Dr. Sawyer and the White House physician, Dr. Joel, and I can't remember his last name, were present when he just kind of grabbed his chest and got a funny look on his face, and he died.
Mm-hmm.
So a copy of the Saturday Evening Post that she was reading to him at the time of his death is there. A copy of the Marion Daily Star containing the centennial edition, July 5th, 1922, and that was a gift from the Harding Publishing Company. And, of course, Harding and Mrs. Harding were back for that celebration in 1922, and that was the only other time that they were back in Marion until he was brought back as a corpse. A photostatic copy of the Articles of Incorporation of the Harding Memorial Association, presented by, at that time, Secretary of State Thad Brown, Secretary mm-hmm. of State of Ohio. A copy of the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution of the United States of America, and those were both presented by a private individual. A copy of Rededicating America by Shortmire, also presented by an individual. A copy of the original painting of General Francis Marion, from whom Marion was named.
Oh, mm-hmm.
A copy of the address by President Harding before the American Red Cross on December the 13th of 1922, and a picture of President Harding and John Barton Payne and the annual report of the American Red Cross from 1923, and that was presented by the American National Red Cross. And I believe John Barton Payne was a grandson of Clara Barton.
Okay, okay.
A souvenir of Cooper Post number 117, Grand Army of the Republic of Marion, Ohio. And very interesting enough, I have a GAR ribbon from the Cooper Post, GAR 117 at Marion, Ohio, that I bought at a Civil War show a number of years ago that will eventually go to the Marion County Historical Society. A copy of What a Country Boy Did with 200 Pounds of Type. Kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Postage stamps that were in use at the time, presented by the Postmaster of the United States. A souvenir gold medal of the memorial, presented by the Whitehead and Hogue Company of Newark, New Jersey. And there are some of those around. I actually have one. A plaque presented by Canby Large Knights of Pythias, number 51, of Marion, Ohio. Drawings of the memorial, presented by Henry Hornbostel and Eric Fisher Wood, and if you remember, they were the architects out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Copy of speeches at congressional memorial services to the late president held on February the 27th of 1924, presented by then-Senator Frank Willis. a copy of the last speeches of Warden Harding on his Alaska tour, large and small certificates issued to contributors of the Memorial Fund program of the Cornerstone Laying, and photographs of Warren Harding and Florence Kling Harding, souvenir postcards and buttons of campaigns, postcards of the home, the vault in the cemetery and memorial, a copy of pencil points containing designs of the Harding Memorial, a copy of the Kiwanis magazine dated October of 1925, the Harding Memorial dedication of Stanley Park, Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, and those were presented by the Harding Memorial Association. Quite a bunch of stuff there.
Oh, yeah.
And, of course, the people in Canada and Alaska loved him. An emblem in memory of Florence Kling Harding presented by the Girl Scouts of Marion. A plaque presented by Buckeye Area Number 337, Fraternal Order of Eagles. A Marion yearbook of 1924 presented by the Marion Chamber of Commerce. A souvenir presented by the Marion County Odd Fellows Association. A copy of the Constitution of the State of Ohio, and a roster of the members-elect of the Senate and House of Representatives of the 86th General Assembly of Ohio, presented by Edmund Hill. I think he was a member of the Assembly at the time. A Bible and a silk American flag. A 1926 United States coin of issue presented by the Marion Savings Bank by its directors and employees. The emblem of the Improved Order of Red Men, presented by the Red Men of Ohio, and that's a lodge I haven't heard that name for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
A printer's stick that was used by President Harding, and resolutions presented by the Marion Typographical Union number 675. Another silk American flag presented by the Bird McGinnis Post number 162 of the American Legion. Timetables of the Erie, Hocking Valley, and the Big Four Railroads. A certificate of membership in the Sons of the American Revolution, presented by the General Francis Marion Chapter here in Marion. A plaque presented by the Loyal Order of Moose, Marion Lodge number 889. A trestle board presented by Warren Harding Lodge number 250 of the Free and Masons Lodge. The Holy Bible from the Masonic Fraternity, a lambskin apron and official button from the Marion Lodge number 70, F&AM,
mm-hmm.
A Masonic penny with President Harding's mark from the Marion Chapter number 62 of the Royal Arch Masons, a Malta degree jewel from Marion Commandery number 36, Knights Templar, a shrine emblem from the Marion Shrine Club, Scottish Rite 32nd degree emblem from the Marion Scottish Rite Club, a grotto emblem from Cagner Grotto, Marion, and a 1926 roster of the Masonic Bodies of Marion, Ohio. And I'm just about done. Pictures of the funeral honor guard at the tomb, Mrs. Harding and Boy Scouts. A copy, and by the way, that was presented by Adam Bauer. He was a photographer here in Marion at the time. A copy of the Marion Daily Star, dated May 29th of 1926. A history and list of membership of the Republican Glee Club from Columbus, Ohio. And an original life membership certificate from the Marion Elks Lodge, of which he was a member.
Wow.
And that's what's in the cornerstone.
I wonder what the condition of all those items is at this point.
You know, I don't know. When they removed the cornerstone from the courthouse a number of years ago, the contents in that box were in perfect condition, and it had been in there since the courthouse was built.
Mm-hmm.
And they were in really good condition, with the exception, as Charlie always liked to say, there were some silverfish in there.
Right.
Now, how in the world those silverfish ever survived in there is beyond me. But that just, Charlie just couldn't get over that.
He would notice something like that, yes.
Yeah, it would. That would have been exactly what it felt like he would do. Yeah. Yeah, so there you go. So I don't know whether they ever plan to do any kind of an official opening of that or not. And again, I'm going to have to go out and take a look sometime, and I don't know in my research. I'm not even sure I know in which corner it is. I'm going to have to do some investigating work and find out what corner it's located in. So next time around, I think in another 3 or 4 weeks, I want to talk about Marion schools.
Oh, that would be interesting.
And the development of the Marion school.
Right.
You know, we had an awful lot of one-room schoolhouses
here
at one time.
Yep. Okay, well, we have a little less than a minute, Fred. It's been good to have you on again. You always... or a plethora of information?
Well, I've got, a lot of information taken from the Marion County Historical Society. There have been a lot of researchers over the years that have compiled a lot of research.
The place is WWGH 107.1 FM.
Catch you later.
In tune with WWGH.
Okay, catch you
and
later.
And we have a lot for you today, including the person we've been talking about for such a long time that was going to come again to WWGH, Mr. McFeely from Mr. Rogers.
Speedy delivery.
Hey! Boy, that sure sounds familiar.